This week on Best in Show, what does the fall film festival season have in store for movie lovers and awards voters? It's all on once Venice kicks off, so we're here to pick some highlights. Plus, with Struck Work on our minds, we've programmed our own labor-themed film festival, so you can add some solidarity to your forever watch list. This is Best in Show, a limited podcast series brought to you by The Letterboxd Show. I am Mia Lee Vicino, the West Coast editor here at Letterboxd, and Best in Show is all about awards season and the film ecosystem. We've kicked off a little early this season due to the SAG-AFTRA and WGA strike action, so welcome to another strike special episode of the show. With me are my Best in Show besties, Hollywood veteran, and our editorial producer, Brian Formo.
Hey, Bradley Cooper's back. You gotta get hay back.
Hey. And our editor-in-chief, Gemma Gracewood.
Bonjour.
Okay, oui. Quickly, Brian, what is this fall film festival phenomenon for those who need an explainer?
Well, it is a three-month season of festivals with big red carpets, big awards, and usually bigger stars, but we'll get into why it's going to be a little different this year. It kicks off in Venice on the water at the end of August, and then it heads to North America, where we have Toronto, Telluride, Mill Valley, New York Film Festival, then AFI in Los Angeles.
And as the non-North American in the group, I'd like to point out that it's not just North America. The Northern Hemisphere autumn also sees fests such as the London Film Festival, Tokyo International Film Festival, and Korea's Busan Festival in October. And then there are genre festivals like Fantastic Fest in Austin, Beyond Fest in LA, and those kinds of fests are attracting more and more awards-worthy titles. Last year, Decision to Leave and Banshees of Inisherin both turned up at Fantastic Fest.
And you turned up right back in North America at the end there. So
I did. I got to meet my wonderful Lydia Tarr on the New York Film Festival red carpet. And that is the first Tarr mention of obligatory Tarr mentions in Best in Show.
Yeah. And then in October and November, the Academy has a few big events. In October, they have a big gala. This year's Sofia Coppola is receiving an award. They also have the Governor's Awards, which are lifetime. So it's like two lifetime achievement awards, lots of awards. When the Academy starts throwing parties, if the celebs are showing up on the carpet, that means we are full steam ahead.
Okay, Brian, I have to stop you there. I can't start to think about awards season yet. I'm barely entering fall festival mode. So that's where I would like to stay for right now. Speaking of, let's dive right in. This slate is packed, but my most anticipated is easily Yorgos Lanthimos's Poor Things, which is premiering at Venice alongside a canal full of other hot, hot, hot titles. Sofia Coppola, who we just mentioned, has her Priscilla. And Wes Anderson's wonderful story of Henry Sugar, as well as Pablo Larraín's El Conde, and many, many more.
Also, what is sure to be this year's best movie about a famous conductor with a complicated personal life, Bradley Cooper's Maestro. And thus, our second obligatory Best in Show Tarr mention is complete. Venice also sees Oscar winner Ryusuke Hamaguchi back after Drive My Car with Aku wa Sonzai Shinai, or Evil Does Not Exist. We know nothing about it, except that Sideshow and Janice films have already snapped that up. Moving on, I am intrigued by Ava DuVernay's Origin, which looks at the cultural hierarchy of America. No big deal. I feel like that will pair well with Killers of the Flower Moon this season. Out of competition, I just want to note, Quentin Dupieux is such a funny filmmaker, and his artist biopic, Dali, looks bonkers. It's totally stacked with French stars. It's got an exclamation on the end. What more could I need?
And several A's.
Several, many, many A's.
Several A's. Dali. That's fun. More stylization like that.
I think you should start spelling your name like that.
Yeah.
Brian.
With the exclamation.
Yeah, with the exclamation. Yep.
I just want to note that film festival season, it's the most wonderful time of the year. There'll be new David Fincher that once called the killer, and Michael Mann's Ferrari is near. It's the most wonderful time of the year.
Bravo, bravo. My dream of finally having a Best in Show musical episode is coming true.
My inner Burr Lives.
My favorite.
This is an award season podcast, but I think the reason why so many of us are in this racket is because the festival season.
Yeah, full festival season is movie Christmas. It's like, you know how Christmas itself is just, you know how Christmas itself is just kind of getting earlier and earlier each year. I think, you know, film fans have just always known that. We do need to move on from Venice. Mm-hmm. Just to note that we will have the intrepid George Fenwick and Ayanna Murray last seen with Ella Kemp at Cannes. They will be hitting the gondolas in their striped tops. So stay tuned for some Venice coverage. If you are lucky enough to go, look out for the letterbox microphone. But like so many actors, none of us three are going to Venice this year. Instead, we're spreading ourselves across some of the North American festivals. Brian, you are first to leave home and head towards the Christmas lights of Telluride?
Yes, Telluride, Colorado, but I can't tell you with certainty what I'll be seeing, but that has more to do with how Telluride releases the information about what is playing there. It's like this silly thing. Well, okay. I think, because Telluride is kind of like this inside club of execs and major players, plus like a lot of Colorado or just people who have been going for many years who create this or turn this into a vacation for themselves, they have a little ritual where they don't announce what is playing there until a chartered flight from LA takes off from LAX at 6 a.m. the day the festival starts. So they release their actual films that are playing there the day that the festival starts, but
that's so silly and sneaky. What's
yeah,
the point?
You can tell what's playing there by kind of reading how things are designated at other festivals. So Alexander Payne's The Holdovers, Emerald Fennell's Saltburn, Jonathan Glazer's Holocaust Follow-Up to Under the Skin. They're all listed as kind of like when they're playing at TIFF, it's the international premiere or the... Even though Saltburn is a London production, when it's playing at London, it's the international premiere. And then Jonathan Glazer's Zone of Interest, that is listed as the Canadian premiere. That all those types of designations means that they're playing at Telluride first. There's a weird one that maybe means the Texas premiere of Gareth Edwards' The Creator, which is a huge sci-fi epic. It says Texas premiere on there, so maybe that means it's going to Telluride, and which wouldn't be that surprising because that's where Arrival had its North American premiere. So one thing, there's a lot of chatter of The Bike Riders, which is Jeff Nichols' new film with Tom Hardy, Jodie Comer, and Austin Butler, that should turn up there. What I really want, we already mentioned it, I really hope that Martin Scorsese's Killers of the Flower Moon shows up there with a tribute. It is their 50th year of having a festival in this tiny, tiny town, silver mining town / brothel town in San Juan Mountains of John Denver's Rocky Mountain High, Colorado. Marty has gone there to give a few tributes to other filmmakers himself, like in 2019 for Agnes Varda, the wonderful Agnes Varda. So hopefully he gets one this year because that's like the movie I want to see the most. Telluride is a really brief festival. It's a lot of fun if you're there, but it's very brief. It ends every year on Labor Day, and then it's TIFF, which Gemma is going to.
I'm still thinking about how much I'd like to go on a bike ride with Tom Hardy and Jodie Comer and Austin Butler, but
And Michael Shannon. I left
and
him
Michael,
out. Sorry.
Oh, and Michael Shannon. Yeah.
How could we omit Michael Shannon? What? Jeff Nichols' muse.
Exactly. I want to go on bike ride with all of those people. Speaking of bike riding and a filmmaker who has always, always had great bicycle representation in his movies, Toronto International Film Festival opens with Hayao Miyazaki's The Boy and the Heron. On the awards front, I know, Mia, you're not ready to talk about awards season yet, but I'm just going to say this. I feel like that is going to be an interesting one, what with Across the Spider-Verse and Nimona and even Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Mutant Mayhem pulling out the artistic goods this year. Plus, we've still got Robot Dreams to come. And that film
Chicken
is so
Run
good.
Chicken Run 2, Dawn of the Nugget.
Chicken Run 2, Dawn of the Nugget. So, but there might be some warm Academy vibes around this being Miyazaki's final film. But the US distributor G-Kids would have to go up against Netflix and Sony and co. And as we know, award season does not always award, you know, it's a funny old beast. But I am excited for The Boy and the Heron, along with a lot of Letterboxd members. Other things to look out for. Well, the last time he was at TIFF, he won the audience award with Jojo Rabbit. Taika Waititi is back with Next Goal Wins, which feels like it was made eons and eons ago, and it's taken this long to get to a festival, and it's got a beautiful cast of Pacific Island actors alongside Michael Fassbender, who may not be allowed to go to what would have been their first big international festival, depending on, you know, where things fall with agreements with SAG-AFTRA. But that's, you know, definitely going to be one of the big comedies of the fest. I've never been more intrigued by a film than Nicholas Larson's Mother Couch, in which Alan Burstyn plays the titular mother who sits herself down on a green couch in a furniture shop and refuses to get up. And her three estranged children, played by Ewan McGregor, alert.
Woo, woo, woo.
Rhys Ifans, alert.
Woo.
And for Brian, Lara Flynn Boyle, alert.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, why not? They all have to figure out why.
Twin Peaks.
Yeah. Speaking of mothers, Wendy Bednarz's feature debut Yellow Bus looks like it will absolutely destroy me. It's about a mother looking for justice for the death of her daughter on a sweltering school bus. And I already can't even, but it's looking like a beautiful film. And as you both know, I am a Midnight Madness fan. So I have eyes on some of those films, including the actor Finn Wolfhard has made a slasher summer camp comedy called Hell of a Summer with his friend Billy Brick. And that's just going to be a lot of fun. I can already feel it. There's so much more. It's ridiculous. Fortunately, TIFF keep a really great up-to-date HQ on Letterboxd. So give them a follow. Mia, your dream of a musical episode continues to come through. Start spreading the news.
Bop. Ba-na-dum.
I'm going to NIFF. Ba-ba-na-dum. Yes, yes, I am. So the New York Film Festival lineup this year is truly a cinephile's dream. So we have got the aforementioned Priscilla from Sofia Coppola as the centerpiece and Ferrari from Michael Mann as the closer. Whew. But then we've also got two new Hong Sang-soo films, two of them.
Two of them, plus
a bunch of Cannes Prize winners like Brian, you already mentioned, but Zone of Interest, and then Anatomy of a Fall, Fallen Leaves, and About Dry Grasses. But for me, it is all about the return of two of my all-time favorite filmmakers, Yorgos Lanthimos with Poor Things and Todd Haynes with May, December, the latter of which I know Brian and I are both deliriously excited about and also deliriously jealous that Gemma has already seen it.
Oh my gosh, it's true, it's true. I buried the lead about where I actually am. I am not in my usual Auckland, New Zealand. I am in Melbourne, Australia for the Melbourne International Film Festival, and May, December is pretty much all anyone here is talking about. I saw it at the New Zealand International Film Festival last month, where it was also a hit. And I want to not talk about it too much because, I didn't know much about it, except it's Todd Haynes and Julianne Moore. So, you know, catnip. And she is doing her best work for him as always. She's completely invented a voice for this character from the ground up. And then Natalie Portman has come into the fold. And of course, you're not going to Natalie Portman your way into a Todd Haynes and Julianne Moore joint without also doing the work. She is as you've never seen her. And so again, as the non-North American of this Best in Show trio, I do think it's worth noting that these regional festivals like Sydney in June, New Zealand in July, Locarno, Melbourne in August, the newly revived Edinburgh are worth paying close attention to because of their immediacy to Cannes, they tend to pick up a lot of the big winners, you know, and so you get to see them just a few weeks after they've won their awards. And so we've had Anatomy of a Fall, which is excellent. How to Have Sex, which is excellent. Banala Nadama, which is just, I saw in an IMAX theatre, which is ridiculous. That's how Myth treats their first-time filmmakers. And Inside the Yellow Cocoon Shell, which won the Camera d'Or and has just opened in its home country of Vietnam. I met the director of that, Pham Thien Am, yesterday. He's so cool. And he was saying that Vietnamese cinemas are all Cocoonheimer at the moment. He's like, there's no Barbieheimer, it's Cocoonheimer. Anyway, just making the point that Letterboxd is super useful for seeing how these films are tracking around the world before they come to North America, and that May December is just chef's kiss.
Woo, woo, we are burning up with film festival fever. It is true, but as we alluded to in previous Best in Show episodes, these film festivals will most likely be running a little bit differently than in years past.
Yeah, that's right. Mia, on red carpet stuff, my inbox is full of emails from publicists with talent attending lists. The directors very much attending, but almost all of the actors are asterisked as pending waiver. And, which is interesting.
I know.
And they're all using that word. And it's like, if we learned anything from Strike Captain Kate Comer in our last episode of Best in Show, it's that waiver. It's the wrong word. But basically what it means is that a lot of the films that were completed long before the strike started, especially outside of America and outside of SAG-AFTRA rules and according to their own union's rules, are asking for permission to be able to take their actors to festivals. So ostensibly, they're going to be allowed to take their casts and writers, but it's a case of everybody dotting I's and making sure they're not crossing T's they shouldn't be crossing.
Yeah, so two stars that have already gotten cleared are Dakota Johnson and Sean Penn. They were cleared for a promotional interim agreement by SAG-AFTRA for TIFF for the movie Daddy-O. So they'll be on those carpets. That was Daddy-O was one of those titles that also had like the it was labeled Canadian premiere, which means it's probably at Telluride. Telluride is usually a very starry affair. They don't have red carpets, but generally you're like in line for coffee with Isabelle Huppert.
Because I'll have a coffee with Isabelle Huppert before I go on my bike ride with Austin Butler.
I'd be too scared to have a coffee with her. It would make me too anxious. I'd need something uncaffeinated.
I tell you who nobody is having coffee with in Venice, even though she's only a producer on a project, is Cate Blanchett. So who could go to Venice being a producer of a film, but basically knows that it will be way too much publicity at a time when actors are on strike. So let it be known weeks and weeks ago that she will not be showing up.
But it will be interesting to see how many more folks get this promotional interim agreement like Dakota and Sean did get, because, you know, that is part of the buzz building are these red carpets.
Yes. So we have about a week or two up our sleeves to prepare for fall film festival season. But because this season is different because of the strike and because Letterboxd is all about the love of cinema, we decided to curate a little Best in Show labor movement film festival of our own. Here's our lineup, which, not to brag, gives Venice a run for its money. It has been a huge, huge show, but Best in Show is, of course, all about celebrating cinema. So, to finish off, me and my besties, Gemma and Brian, each picked a film that we all had to watch with two requirements. One, it had to be good, okay, with some awards notice. And two, it had to be about the struggle for workers' rights. So get out that Geiger counter, because we're starting with the earliest film on our list. It's my choice, Silkwood, 1983, directed by my man, Mike Nichols, screenplay by, get this, Nora Ephron and Alice Arlen. Phew! Okay, what a lineup, first off.
Massive, massive, massive pick. What a lineup. Massive pick.
And I haven't even gotten into who stars in this film. Okay, here we go, Meryl Streep as Karen Silkwood, the titular role. We also have Cher. Cher plays
Karen Silkwood's roommate?
They all live together with Kurt Russell. So you have Meryl Streep, Kurt Russell, Cher. They all live in this little house together in Oklahoma, and they all work at the nuclear power plant together, and everything is so happy and going well. No, I wish. So this is the story of Karen Silkwood, a metallurgy worker at a plutonium processing plant who was purposefully contaminated, psychologically tortured, and possibly murdered to prevent her from exposing blatant worker safety violations at the plant. So this is based off of a true story. And it's a disturbing one at that. So Karen was the first woman elected to the local Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union's bargaining committee, and she ended up blowing the whistle on numerous safety violations. And then, on November 13th, 1974, she picked up important documents to bring to a meeting with a New York Times reporter and a union official, but her car mysteriously crashed on the way. It's pretty shady because it turns out that she had a high dose of sedatives in her system, and then the rear of the car was hit despite the collision being head on, and then most damning of all, perhaps the documents were missing. So nothing was ever, you know, like legally confirmed, but her father and children did end up suing the Kerr-McGee plant that she worked at for the plutonium contamination. They settled out of court with the family receiving over $1 million. So something happened here.
That's chump change. Something happened here, and that is chump change. There should be statues to Karen Silkwood across America. Everywhere there is a J. Robert Oppenheimer statue, there should be a Karen Silkwood statue.
Yes, and speaking of statues, Gemma, this film was nominated for quite a few Academy Awards, but it was up against Terms of Endearment. That James L. Brooks melodramedy swept the Oscars that year. It picked up Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actress for Shirley MacLaine, and more. But Silkwood still held its own, okay? It was nominated for Best Director Mike Nichols, Best Actress Meryl Streep, Best Supporting Actress Cher, Best Screenplay, written directly for the screen, Nora Ephron and Alice Arlen, and then finally, Best Film Editing, Sam Osteen.
But speaking of statues, Kurt Russell is also shirtless and dousing himself with beer.
There should be statues of shirtless Kurt Russell across
America. So where was his Best Supporting Actor nomination, okay?
Actually, it was with the Golden Globes. That's where
okay.
It was.
Well, we'll give the Golden Globes a point for the first time in history.
Speaking of bad American institutions. Anyway, given that I know what you were going to ask, Mia, so I'm just going to jump in here and say it as well because it was the first thing on my notes. Given all of this, the importance of the story, especially in the fact that it makes a perfect double feature with Oppenheimer, given the stat cast, given Nora Ephron as co-writer, given it's a Mike Nichols, why is this film so damn hard to find?
I know. It's totally unavailable to stream or rent. And then I even checked my local library and all the copies were checked out. At least they have it at the library, though.
That's kind of a good sign.
That's actually, now that I say it, I'm like, wait, actually, Silkwood's going around.
It's hard to find actually because of Disney. It was one of the enemies of this current strike, particularly Bob Iger in his interview in my home state of Idaho at the billionaire camp that I never went to, and I was a resident and paid taxes in Idaho. But he was there putting down saying that what people want out of this is inconceivable. But something that is inconceivable is that this movie has all those, this cast that you mentioned, the director, the nominations would be so hard to find. But that's because when Disney absorbed ABC's catalog, they deemed it not worthy of adding to their digital library.
Man, oh man. So in other words, at this moment in time, if all of your library's copies are checked out and you don't have a friend with a DVD library as big as Mitchell Beaupre's, then it's okay to borrow this from Auntie's VHS closet, if you know what I mean. Because Silkwood is worth watching in this time and place. Because so there's the story itself, obviously an important story to make into a movie, but as we know, biopics can often be very play-by-play, quite rote, quite melodramatic. This is not that, right? There are shots in this that are pure horror, just pure horror. It's a horror disguised as a biopic, I think.
No, absolutely. And then I also just want to partially credit this recent Silkwood craze with the success of Oppenheimer. May I say that? Because both films are about these horrific nuclear safety issues that have these horror elements as well. I think Oppenheimer also has some very, very harrowing scenes and images. But yeah, both are about the nuclear safety issues, and they feature Los Alamos. They remember they Karen Silkwood and crew go there to get tested, and that's where she's found to have 40 times the legal limit of radioactive contamination in her system, which is obscene.
Both get followed by authorities who should not be following private citizens as well.
Mm-hmm. The parallels are there. And then this is actually kind of a wild parallel that I am going to draw, because Silkwood also has ties to Barbie. And I need to share this. I need to share this or else. The costume designer for the film Silkwood is Anne Roth. So she's a frequent Mike Nichols collaborator.
Bus Stop Barbie.
Yes. Yes. You got it.
Bus Stop Barbie.
That's exactly what I'm going to say.
Yes.
So the costume designer for this, Anne Roth, she's regularly collaborating with Mike Nichols and Meryl Streep and all these greats. She has two Oscars. And what you may recognize her from most, though, is as the older woman that Barbie meets at the bus stop, whom she calls so beautiful, to which Anne responds, "I know it."
Ah! Yeah. Ah! Yeah.
So, yeah. And,
I am Bus Stop Barbie.
We love Bus Stop Barbie. I'm a big fan of Anne Roth. Some of my favorites of her long, long, long filmography of costumes is Postcards from the Edge, Closer, Clute, 9 to 5, The Birdcage, The Talented Mr. Ripley, The Hours, and of course, Mamma Mia. Oh, she did that disco jumpsuit.
Yeah. Oh my God. Speaking of Mamma Mia.
Meryl exactly. And Cher. Cheryl is what we could call them. So it's just wild to think that 35 years later, after making Silkwood, where they're roommates, they would play mother and daughter in Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again. I think that's beautiful. Okay.
I think it's incredible. I also, I think it's incredible that you have Meryl and Cher in a movie together, and Meryl is the only one we hear singing.
Yes.
You've got Cher in a movie, but it's Meryl who does all the singing. Oh, man. The Amazing Grace, closing credits, lost it. So I saw this film when it came out. I was so young, but I had the kind of family who would take us to see important movies. And I was way too young to watch such a grown-up movie, but New Zealand at that time was deep in the nuclear-free movement. And so this was a big film for us to watch, because it just doubled down on what we as a nation and young children were out marching on the streets about. It, you know, forever imprinted on my mind how dangerous plutonium is, but also how dangerous union life is. Like unionists, whistleblowers are absolute heroes. And I also fully agree. Like, I love how it's a film that is about the workplace and about how unions make themselves relevant and powerful in the workplace. But it's also a drama about home life and domesticity among adults who live together, not in a traditional family structure. And I guess I just wanted to call out Alex Kittle's 4.5-star Letterboxd review, which asks, why does the Letterboxd poster for this look like it's some sexy threesome movie? Yes. And it's actually a drama about evil corporations and workers' rights and radiation poisoning and mullets and labor unions and Cher as a butch lesbian.
Yeah. We need to be talking about this.
Yeah.
It doesn't quite reach the pantheon of a throuple, but they're almost a throuple. And that's one of my favorite dynamics of this when Kurt Russell does leave for a little bit, they both miss him.
Yeah, yeah.
And he misses both of them. And it is like there's another Oppenheimer. They're the Trinity.
Oh my God. They are the Trinity. They're kind of the perfect, they're literally the perfect American nuclear family.
Except for the Confederate flag.
Okay. That part we
just overlook, right? We just overlook.
I watched it on an airplane, and I was hoping that people around me would overlook. There's a lot of lingering shots on that.
It's almost a character in itself.
But it tells you a lot about the character of Drew, and he's a really interesting. I actually love the portrayal of the kind of masculine ego when a woman who at the beginning of the film just goes to her job and comes home from her job, by the end of the film is this, you know, is getting flown off to Washington, getting put up in hotels for union meetings. Like, her status has changed within their relationship. And it's just as much Drew's story of coming to terms with his partner becoming more relevant and powerful than him as it is, you know, Karen's story or the story of Cher's mullet. Yeah, I love it. And also I love that it's rural America. But the next film that Brian asked us to watch moves us and its main character to the city.
Yeah, so the one that I chose, we're approaching film festival season, so film number two in our strike slash labor movement film festival is The Killing Floor from 1984, directed by Bill Duke and written by Leslie Lee. And if we're looking at like film festival approaches to this, this is something that didn't get a lot of recognition at the time. It was made for PBS, which is the government-funded television broadcaster. It was part of the American Playhouse series that went on to win the Peabody Award for its contribution for American television excellence. A couple of the movies they made later, people know of more, like series entries like The Thin Blue Line and El Norte and Stand and Deliver, were all inducted into the National Registry. But The Killing Floor was one of their first films, and it was Bill Duke's first film. And he is kind of having a moment as a director, an overdue moment, and this would kind of fill that space within your watching when something that got overlooked is coming back, because this is actually on the Criterion Channel currently, partially to do with Deep Cover being one of my favorite movies of all time, being officially a part of the Criterion Collection that Bill Duke directed later. So there was an award. It did win the Sundance Film Festival Special Jury Prize, and it definitely deserved that. There is something, so I did put up top that this is PBS, and this is a PBS production. So there's some voiceover that sounds, you know, like what you would expect from that. This in a lot of ways feels like a movie that your teacher might wheel out on a TV stand instead of teaching, but you'd be lucky if a teacher showed this in school, because it's actually highly educational, upsetting, and handsomely made.
Yeah, I was going to say, because to sort of say it's a PBS movie sounds almost pejorative, but it is so beautiful to look at. My God, the greens, the blacks, the reds in this film. It's just was stunning on my eyeballs, regardless of the content.
Yeah, I think it's really just like you kind of have to, for a lot of modern audiences, I think have to get over the voiceover. But like he really puts you in a time and place and really takes on the union movement from multiple angles. So it concerns a black Southern worker, Frank Custer, who moves north, called the Great Migration, during World War I to find work in the Chicago slaughterhouses. He joins a union during the good days because production was necessary. It was really ramping up for the war effort.
Just clarify, so The Killing Floor, the title, it's referring to the slaughterhouses, like as in the floor, the place where the main work is done, processing the animals, right?
Yeah, and early in the film, they kind of show all the different levels of the slaughterhouse, which kind of alluded to. I kind of feel like that's what Bill Duke and Leslie Lee are doing with the approach to labor, of kind of like all these various floors for people, and how they're going to be kind of like when times are great, it'll feel like everyone is doing well, but in very bad times, they're going to pit people against each other to kind of to create an infighting that the capitalist system often does.
I wonder if that sounds like anything that's happening now.
Yes. So he joins a union during the good days because production was necessary for the war effort, but it goes bust when the servicemen, including one of his best friends who traveled up with him from the South, when the servicemen return and they think they deserve all the jobs that people were working while they were away fighting war. This causes racial tensions to brew to a breaking point, not just within the city, but within the union itself. And I'm choosing this one because while the film is pro-labor and pro-unions, it shows like how every collective, people are used against each other, particularly new immigrant groups versus the last immigrant group who fought for their peace, and now they don't want other people to have what they had to fight for. And here, Black people fighting to receive the equal treatment that their union contracts dictate versus the newly arrived Black workers from the Great Migration and European immigrants who can only find work by being scabs. And this is purposefully done by the company to sow divisions against specific groups.
Yeah, I loved how unflinching Bill Duke is in the portrayal of the intersectional politics in The Killing Floor, like where Frank, the country boy, recognizes that there's more power in integrating with other unions and, you know, other unions with white members. But Heavy Williams, who's the older man on The Killing Floor, played incredibly by Moses Gunn, doesn't want Black workers to put themselves and their families in jeopardy by stopping work. So it's sort of like, is it about, you know, putting food on our immediate family's tables, or is it about the wider, bigger universal family getting, you know, advancing workers' rights more universally? There's a great scene I wanted to highlight. That amazing conversation between Heavy and Frank on the workers' floor with all the workers around them. And just a note that this clip contains language used in context that may nevertheless offend some listeners.
You don't even see how grateful he is when he comes to this table for this little bit of food, when they smile and thank the good Lord for it.
Look, Heavy, we're all grateful for it. Maybe it's time the Packers did do something for us. But it wasn't the Packers that tried to give us raises so as we could live halfway decent. That was the union. If the Packers paid us what we deserved, we wouldn't need no handouts. Wouldn't have to live from week to week. You don't know who your friends are.
I know what the hell a friend is, nigga. It's when somebody comes to your side when you're down and out, when everybody else don't give a good damn for you.
Isn't that just, I mean, that's just such an incredible conversation that kind of highlights the very specific concerns among the Black workers in this film. And not only that, but it's also an incredible acting performance. And I was watching this AFI interview with Bill Duke, who was talking about how he works with actors. And he talks about how he wants to work with actors who can bring it, and they certainly bring it in this film. And what he means by that is that great actors become. So in the process of acting, this is so amazing, listen to this. He talks about them falling into a darkness and trusting something you have no control over. I'm highlighting this because, you know, there is a difference between AI and a human who can fall into darkness and trust that that's okay. You know, we're in the middle of a strike involving actors. So he says, you know, so what good directors do, what Bill Duke does is let the actor know as they are falling backwards into the darkness that we are going to catch them.
So one highlight of The Killing Floor for me was Alfre Woodard's performance. She plays Custer's wife, Maddie, and she filmed The Killing Floor 10 years before starring in Spike Lee's Crooklyn. So this is an earlier one of her credits, and wow, she's really knocking it out of the park. I mean, domestic work is such an unsung aspect of labor movements, I feel like, you know, like, while the union members are out striking and fighting for their rights and doing all this important work, someone also has to be at home, you know, caring for their kids and cleaning the house and cooking, etc. And then they also provide emotional support for their partner when they come home from a long, hard day or a really long trip to Chicago, as Custer does in this film. And, you know, oftentimes this duty falls on the woman, though sometimes, like in Silkwood, it does not. I was really interested in the juxtaposition between the way that Mattie and then Kurt Russell's character Drew in Silkwood handle supporting their revolutionary partners. Like, look how quickly it took for Drew to get so mad and overwhelmed about having to perform these duties. Whereas Mattie is really, you know, she takes it on. It really makes you think. It's interesting about the devaluation of what is traditionally women's work.
It's so true, Mia. And I think a palate cleanser for you might be the British film Misbehavior, which is about the clash between feminists, women's rights activists, and the Miss World competition. And there is a beautiful scene where there's a convention of women's rights activists, and next door there's a crash, and the people looking after the babies are the husbands and the boyfriends. It's a beautiful scene.
Imagine husbands and boyfriends taking care of the child they helped make. Oh, what a world. You know who really needs to watch The Killing Floor is Drew from Silkwood. I think that would really help him learn some solidarity forever.
They do sing in the movie. They do sing in the movie. Okay, okay, okay. So I love this AFI interview so much. Thank you, Mia. I'm just going to throw to them singing Solidarity Forever in the movie, and then this beautiful quote from Bill: in the spirit of solidarity and the importance of studios in the movie making equation, listen to what Bill Duke has to say about studios and this film.
I just want to thank studio network heads, the producer Elsa Rosbach, people who believed in this vision and allowed me to make the movie I wanted to make. Without the collaboration and cooperation of the many, many people who gathered all the people and rehearsed with them the songs and the march, and it's like, you know, I have the final say, but if I don't have people around me that support my vision, I don't exist. And that trust created what you're seeing. It wasn't an easy journey, but it was a journey worth taking. I was fortunate enough to get those actors, which I loved and wonderful, and talk about something I believed in, bringing people together for a common cause.
Going off of that, speaking of bringing people together, I wanted to highlight Jamel Bowie's fantastic review of this, which he says on Letterboxd: one of very few films that does justice to the experience of the Great Migration, all in the context of a desperate fight for respect and recognition. Like Paul Schrader's Blue Collar, The Killing Floor captures with great precision the exact ways that racism works to segment and divide the working class, not simply through prejudice, but by structuring the experience of class in such a way that workers at the bottom of the race hierarchy are desperate for scraps, and workers at the top feel a kind of chauvinism and superiority. And this, there's a little more in Jamel's review, but that's even like highlighted with the, because we already brought up the postscript of Silkwood. This one has a postscript too, and it kind of talks about like all these figureheads who went on to have really big jobs. And then the majority of people that we follow has this very sad recognition, but it's a beautiful recognition because now they have a film where it says, it lists all of the names of the real people and says, after this moment where the film ends, nothing, they're not on the historical record anymore.
Oh my God, so true. Just to wheel out one more quote from Bill Duke, he said, these are people, if they didn't do what they did, unions would not exist and equal pay would not exist, and I wanted them recognized.
Bill Duke, what
Bill
a guy.
Bill Duke, you legend. My pick, which is... a little more contemporary, made in 2014, set in the 80s, shows the flip side. What happens when seemingly unlikely and unrelated movements do work with each other? Or in other words, die, your gays have arrived. So we are diving into Pride, directed by Matthew Walchus, written by Stephen Beresford, based on an inspirational true story. Many actual real people depicted, some composite characters created for plot reasons. Summer of 1984, Margaret Thatcher is in power.
Boo!
And the National Union of Mine Workers is on strike. At the Gay Pride March in London, a group of gay and lesbian activists decides to raise money to support the families of the striking miners. But there is a problem. The Welsh unionists are a little embarrassed about having lesbians and gays support the miners, supporting them.
Grow up.
This is an award-winning film. It won the Queer Palm at Cannes. It won the BAFTA for Outstanding debut in 2015, and it won the BIFFA, the Best British Independent Film. It also won Best Supporting Actress for Imelda Staunton, Best Supporting Actor for Hot Priest Andrew Scott. It is an absolutely stacked cast. We have Dominic West, Bill Nighy, George Mackay, and the wonderful, and actually I found out after my first watch, very American Ben Schnetzer as Lesbians and Gays Support the Miners Real Life co-founder Mark Ashton, who leads the ensemble. It is, I just love this so much. It is a five-star film every time I watch it. It is a brilliant British ensemble movie in the grand tradition of British ensemble movies about the working classes in the Thatcher years, of which there are many. Mm-hmm. I don't know if there's a specific letterbox list, but if there's not, I'll someone make it and send us the link. I love, love, love the intersectionality in this film. I love that it uses silly Welsh humour to debunk, persistent things like if a gay man looks at a straight man, he will instantly fall in love with him. It's not true, straight men. Get over yourselves. That all lesbians are vegetarians and that union parties are boring. They are not. Unions have the best parties.
Yes. Well,
I can attest to that. My wildest party is the University of Tennessee when we were helping the service workers get a higher wage. We threw hell of a party.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what else to say about this except to say that if you haven't had any reason to put Pride on your watch list yet, can I just tell you that Dominic West and Andrew Scott are in a relationship in this film?
And Dominic West dances his little butt off.
Oh, does he ever? Mm-hmm.
Yes,
okay,
Gemma.
Okay, did you love it? Please tell me you loved it. Please tell me you loved it.
I am so glad that you picked this because it's been in my watch list for ages. I've been meaning to watch it. Every so often, I'll scroll through Andrew Scott's filmography and try to find something to watch. And I don't know how I have not seen this before. It is, I happy cried at the end. I feel like it's rare for me to cry out of happiness watching a movie, but I was so happy at the show of solidarity. It's just really lovely and really empathetic because, you know, it's dealing with pretty upsetting things like homophobia. But it's really careful to not, you know, like explicitly show hate crimes in a way that is like visceral, you know, like it keeps its queer audience in mind. And it's ultimately just this feel good movie without feeling too, you know, like after school, especially like it gets a little treacly at times.
Yeah.
it gets a little saccharine at times, but then it balances out by also having like bite and some really, really sharp humor. I love the little like infighting jokes too, where, you know, I love the scene where they're on the bus and they're singing "Every Woman's a Lesbian at Heart." And then the gay men on the bus are like, "You can't just say that. You can't just make sweeping generalizations about a group." And then they just look at him and then continue singing the song. It's just, I really enjoyed it and I'm glad.
Singing the song to the tune of Solidarity.
It's
forever.
True.
That's the greatest part of including Reggie's mom.
Yeah. Yeah. Including Reggie's mom.
There you go. That was the kicker for me. There was speaking of upsetting things, there was one thing about like the truthfulness of this that I hate that they had to change more so because of for American audiences. But Mark Ashton was the leader of the young Communist Party, and they totally gloss over the communist aspects of this. And when I said that we threw kick-ass parties at University of Tennessee, it was a communist club, so I'm not afraid to say it. but I hate that they basically had to change a little part of this very British or UK set story for American audiences. Be like, that's too far for me to go with this person. So.
I mean, he was general secretary of the Young Communists League. It's quite a big biographical detail to leave out, but
yeah, all they really they like throw in a couple of very, very subtle like Easter eggs almost. Like he like has a communist flag in his room, and then that's really all.
Yeah, I wasn't in love with some of the cheesy moments built through fictional characters, you know, in order to shoehorn homophobia and coming out stories. And, but I don't know. I can see what they were doing. Movies take license. Mm-hmm. It's fine. I will not dock even a half star for that cheesy stuff. I think this is such a beautiful film to show how seemingly disparate groups, especially in these divided times, can work together to build collective action. And I also love how your mention of communism brings us all the way back around to Oppenheimer. Therefore, Pride is also a perfect double feature with Oppenheimer, given that it's led by a Communist Party leader. And just to tie it all back together with Barbie, I would like to finish this Pride section with one last letter that landed in our mailbag that wasn't quite right for Kate Comer, but is perfect for us three. Hello, Letterboxd Show, writes Stucifer on Letterboxd. Stu, his handle is Stucifer. This is my first time listening to the Best in Show pod. That's so cool.
Welcome Stu.
But I was very curious to hear some perspective about the strikes, both what Letterboxd is doing going forward as well as what the future events look like. So thanks for this ep. I wanted to second Gemma's recommendation of Pride. Woo-hoo. It's got Andrew Scott being lovely. It's got labour movement and solidarity. And it's a movie centred on queer people in the 1980s that isn't super sad and about the AIDS epidemic, which, yes, obviously this aspect of queer history is heart-wrenching and infuriating, and I, for one, will never stop grieving. But it's also nice to celebrate our queer elders instead of mourn them all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Stu, that is such a beautiful note, because the other thing about Mark Ashton is he was also an AIDS activist and he did die from AIDS complications. And I love that in this film, Pride, he's living. He is living and breathing, alive, energetic, glorious. He is not dying or dead. It's beautiful. Stu did have an awards question. Here's where it gets relevant. Completely independent of the strikes. Thank you, Stu. Ever since seeing Barbie, I've had the tunes stuck in my head. I'm wondering which song you think they should submit for a Best Song Oscar. Way to pivot away from the strikes, Stu. He writes, my layperson's opinion is that the song that best represents the film's messaging, What Was I Made For, may not be the song from the film that has the best chance of winning, but I would love to hear what you think. Thanks for putting out such great shows.
Thank you for listening, Stu.
So it's funny that Stu asks this, because the last few days, I don't know if my phone was listening to Stu's email, but my Instagram algorithm is full of cute video stories from Barbie's composers and songwriters and producers, already pirouetting for pole position on the disco dance floor of awards land. It just feels like the awards campaign has started already. There's the story about Dua Lipa, who raced back from a massive world tour to rewrite the lyrics for the centerpiece disco track Dance the Night. And she's talking about how she specifically inserted the lyric up as Margot Robbie's arm goes up. I mean, it's wild. I don't know if that would win an award, that story. There's Mark Ronson talking about he and his collaborator Andrew had an emotional experience making the soundtrack. And then there's the story about how Billie Eilish's existential song, the one that Stu calls out, became itself a musical motif throughout the rest of the film as soon as Greta heard it. So who knows? What do you two think?
I'm just Ken. I'm just Ken, 100,000% all the way. I need Ryan Gosling to perform it on the stage. So that's why the strike has to end. That's the sole reason, I think. Not any of the workers' rights issues. It's we need Ryan Gosling up on that stage. But
if there is one reason, yes, if there is one reason for Apple and Amazon to come to the table, it's Ken. Ken at the Oscars.
So I am rooting for I'm Just Ken. You know, Billie Eilish already has an Oscar, lest we forget.
I'm Just Ken falls into the Man or Muppet camp of Oscar-winning songs, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, let's do a silly one. Let's give an award to the silly song. I don't know. It's also, you know, the Dream Ballet, tying back to film history. It's film historic.
They're dancing on a trans flag. They're dancing on the colors of the trans flag.
Yes.
There's a lot that could be celebrated. Brian, I really need to know what Barbie song you're punting for.
Just the exact same reason as Mia. I'm Just Ken for Ryan Gosling and all the other Kens getting on stage. We're all very aware of how much of a cultural dent Barbie has made, but I think yesterday when I was uploading photos of orcas onto my Instagram and it was suggesting that I only put Barbie songs to those photos on Instagram shows just like how huge this is. Where it's like, I'm sorry, this is one of the instances where I'm a Barbie girl doesn't really fit. I'm sorry.
Stu's wonderful Barbie question brings us to a lightning round, a final lightning round of strike movie recommendations. And because I know Mia is going to start with a musical, or at least that's what I'm hoping, that is our call to arms.
Yes, Gemma, this is a musical episode after all, we've decided. And wait, hold up. There's this weird sound coming in. Do you guys hear that?
I do.
Do you hear the people singing the song of angry men? That's right, baby. It's Les Miserables 2012, directed by Tom Hooper. So, truth be told, I have probably seen this movie at least 12 times. I feel like I have probably mentioned it on at least 12 different episodes of all of our Letterboxd show podcasts. And in fact, I just rewatched it a couple of months ago with my girlies, and we were crying, we were cheering, we were singing. The blood of the martyrs will water the meadows of France. So, I know this movie was technically a box office hit, making almost $450 million and scoring a well-deserved Oscar for Anne Hathaway's devastating portrayal of Fantine, but to me, it is still underrated somehow. The choice to have everyone sing live makes it feel so raw and real, and I personally really value authenticity and emotion over pitch-perfect vocals. I think you can save that for Broadway. But for the labor aspect of the movie, Les Mis genuinely did open my eyes to revolution when I watched it as an impressionable young 17-year-old. It portrays the struggle to find employment if you have a criminal record and the tragic lengths that parents have to go to support their children financially. And then it also has the hypocrisies of the law, the gleeful cruelty of landlords. But speaking of, Sacha Baron Cohen and Helen Bonham Carter as the Thénardiers are the showstoppers of the movie. Master of the House is a perennial bop. Okay, Gemma, real quick, bring it home with your Javert hot take.
Oh, look, you know I've got one. I any longtime listener to this pod has heard this before, but, you know, Russell Crowe, he is the sentinel, silent and sure. He fills the darkness with order and light. He got too much criticism for his stony performance as Javert, but the whole point is, you've got to look at it in the context of Russell being besties with Hugh, and Hugh being, you know, the Broadway guy, the showman, the kind of the greatest showman, the sort of most beautiful example of showbiz masculinity. And there's absolutely no way that Russ LaRocque was ever going to match Hugh for energy. So the point is, he needs to be stoic and still.
He just plain looks like a cop. He just does.
It's
okay,
true.
Brian, take it away.
Okay. Well, similar to Mia's Les Mis pick, it's my lightning round selection is something I bring up to everybody, including on this podcast all the time. It's how wonderful and under-heralded Kirsten Dunst is. And she has a film that maybe if you're an old like myself, you knew by the Harvey Weinstein direct-to-video title of All I Wanna Do. But it was called Strike with an exclamation point. It's not about labor, but it is about agency. And Mia brought up the impressionable 17-year-olds, that's what this is about. Okay, so it's about taking a stand against the patriarchal structures of education and the girls' school, led by Kirsten Dunst and Gabby Hoffman, who fight being merged with a boys' school and going co-ed. It failed in the U.S. because the film failed in the U.S. because it was marketed as a girl-crazy comedy.
Of course it was.
Similar to a pop title. But Strike is funny, and it's also very smart, and it has a stacked cast beyond my favorite Kiki. There's Merritt Weaver, Rachel Lee Cook, right after She's All That. Welcome to the Dollhouse's Heather Matarazzo. It's got a Redgrave. A Redgrave, that's classy. That's Lynn Redgrave here. It has a young Vincent Kartheiser as a beatnik heartthrob. It's the type of movie that should be getting the Suits revival treatment because it would find the right audience now, as opposed to then, which is rebellious, free-thinking girls and boys, the exact audience that Harvey Weinstein did not want to appeal to. And there is a little justice in the world, not just because Harvey is in jail, but the movie is now offered on all rental services under, not under its shitty previous title, but as Strike with an exclamation point. There are a lot of titles that have been throwing around for this. But that's how you find it. You find it as Strike exclamation point. But for the purposes of this conversation, everything you need to know about why it's such a great labor movement, even though it's not about labor, but like about organizing, film selection is, it's right there in the opening credits. It was written and directed by two-time Oscar winner and one-time Razzie winner, Sarah Kernachan. But she credits the film, she ends the credits as a film made by everyone who made it. Now that is solidarity. It's very cute.
Speaking of solidarity and songs, I was, for my last pick, incredibly fortunate to see at the New Zealand International Film Festival a new restoration of Bread and Roses, named after the famous Union song, "As we come marching, marching in the beauty of the day." You know the one. Anyway, it's gorgeous. Which is...
Yes, they sing it in Pride.
Yes, they do. Which is New Zealand director mm-hmm. Gaylene Preston's 1993 profile of New Zealand activist and politician Sonia Davies, who was a feminist hero to me and many others growing up. By the time Gaylene got to the negative of her film, it was stuck together and almost destroyed. And she's rescued it just in the nick of time. She's used the resources of the great Sir Peter Jackson, who owns all of the machines you need for this kind of thing. And it's so gorgeous. It was shot on 16 millimeter. So the reds pop, the reds of the nurses' capes pop. Bread and Roses covers the plight of mid-century New Zealand women from World War II through until the late 1950s, which is only a tiny portion of Sonia Davies' life. She died at the age of 90. But what I love is it's the birth of her as an activist. So it shows the part of her life which shows kind of more generally what it takes to get and stay involved rather than any outcomes she achieved later in life. And I just think at a time when a lot of people are on strike for the very first time in their lives, It's a great lesson in how, you know, yes, we are still having to protest this fucking shit. It's also a watershed film for New Zealand filmmakers because Gaylene really swung for the fences in terms of using beautiful long takes with a lot of choreographed action inside them, letting the actors do their very best work with each other rather than getting quite cutty. Feminist Spielberg, as I like to call her. It's relevant Woo-hoo! To Best in Show because it won several awards, including for its lead actress, Genevieve Picot, and for Mick Rose as supporting very, 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 very good man performance. Mia, it's another great example of good masculine domesticity in support of a female activist. And now that the restoration is complete, the distribution task begins. So hopefully it will come your way.
You've sold me. You're calling her feminist Spielberg. You're bringing in positive portrayals of masculinity. I am all in. And, you know, I know it's a lightning round, but if we had the time and I had one pick more, I would have chosen Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris, since she unionizes the House of Dior and learns that in France, the worker is king. We could call this whole thing Les Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris for Bread, Roses, and to Strike! Exclamation point.
And I actually think, even though you guys were trying to bring Lydia Tarr back today, Mrs. Harris at this point has been referenced by far the most on Best in Show.
And I do.
You're right. She's the new Lydia Tarr, and she's actually really nice.
She's actually really nice. And to tie it all up in a beautiful bow, the lyric from Bread and Roses goes, "Hearts starve as well as bodies. Give us bread, but give us roses." The roses are essentially art and culture, such as films like this. So movies, incredibly important in a time of industrial action. We love movies.
We love movies. We love bread. We love roses. Jean Valjean stole a loaf of bread.
And to the execs, up your ziggy with a wah-wah brush.
Thanks so much for listening to Best in Show, a limited award season series brought to you by The Letterboxd Show. We would love for you to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts to help spread the word about all of our podcast shows here at Letterboxd.
You can follow all of us and our HQ page on Letterboxd using the links in our episode notes. Thanks to our crew, Slim, for making us sound amazing, and our production manager, Sophie Shin. Thanks to Letterboxd member Trent Walton for the music, and thanks to everyone enduring the heat of the picket lines and everyone who is honking in support.
And thank you for listening and honking in support. Best in Show is a Tape Deck production.
Honk.
Honk. This is a Tape Deck Podcast.